We get to talk to some really special people now. We've got two of our former past presidents and current directors of Warbirds of America, Bill Harrison and John Baugh. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
So, Bill.
Yeah.
You guys are having way too much fun down here.
We have a lot of fun.
You do.
You know, we feel like we have a message to get to the public, but we ought to give it in a way that they enjoy it as much as possible. You know, when you're talking about war, you can't really make it beautiful. But let's face it, we're really talking about warriors rather than war.
Yeah, absolutely. So, what's happening? Tell me more. We just want information, lots of information. And you're the man. You're the one with all the information.
I don't know. John's got as much information as I. We've both been around here long enough, you know, long enough to grow whiskers in wrong places. And Warbirds has matured a great deal over the last 40 or 50 years that I've been involved, and we have a lot of things going on now that we have airplanes. The Warbirds of today are totally different from when I started. And same thing is true with John. We thought we had nice airplanes, but they wouldn't hold a candle to some of these. You know, when Mustangs were selling for, you know, over $1.5 million, you know, back in the day, you know, I bought a Corsair in El Salvador for $5,000. I mean,
what kind of shape was that in?
I flew it home.
Oh, it was in good shape then.
Well, no. I just flew it home. I mean, in those days, I was 10 feet tall and bulletproof, and now I'm none of the above.
That sounds like a lot of fun. How do you, logistically, you buy an airplane in Salvador, you said? El Salvador.
Right.
You go down there. How do you check yourself out? I mean, how do you just walk in and fly an airplane home? Read the book. Oh, okay.
I mean, it's a single-seat airplane. I mean, it's based upon past experience. You know, I had been flying T-6s and C-Furies and all sorts of things, and I was current in Corsairs.
Okay, well, that explains a lot. Yeah. Because I'm thinking, okay, you go down somewhere to buy an airplane. Do you just show up and sit in the cockpit and figure out where all the switches are?
Well, they're all a little bit different, so that's the first thing you have to do. Isn't that right, John?
Yep. Some of the parts are missing.
Well, the Corsair that I got, it didn't have a handle for the throttle. I mean, for the flaps.
So how'd you put the flaps down?
Well, my mechanic friend that I sent down there to work on it found a DC-3 flap handle and put it up on the left-hand side, and it was totally out of place, but it did what it needed to do, and we got it home.
Do you need flaps to land a Corsair?
Yes. Okay. You can do it without it, but it's much, much better if you have flaps because it slows you down, and it's... You know, the biggest problem with the Corsair is visibility. When the nose comes up, the visibility goes away. So you normally make a curving approach, slightly curved, like they did on the boat, and just a slightly curving approach. And then you roll out and boom. Boom.
Just like Pappy Boyington.
Say again?
Just like Pappy Boyington.
That's it.
How about you, John? Do you have any of these crazy stories?
I can sit and tell you all day long his stories, just on that Corsair alone. He's not telling you everything. They went down there, and one group had Mustangs. One group had these Corsairs. They'd been sitting. They went down with gallons and gallons of STP or something like that.
WD-40.
WD-40.
And Marvel Mystery Oil.
Marvel Mystery Oil.
That's the key.
Yeah. But they all went down there. There's a group of them got together.
55-gallon drum of Marvel Mystery Oil?
About.
No, they put them in the cylinders, and then they went out and had a party. Come back the next day, and some of them would turn. Some would not pull through. So they kept soaking them. They got every one of them running. They hadn't been run in years. And what he's not telling you is how important it is to walk out here and see this gift brought back in every life. There must be an airplane airport around here.
There's an airport somewhere around here.
It's hard to
get. Every one of them enjoyed doing it, but they put their life up in him because these were two entities that were fighting each other, and they told them, when you take off, turn and go back toward the shoreline. Do not crash in the woods because the head, what'd you call them?
The headhunters.
Headhunters are there, you're going to die. So
I carried a machete. Yeah, I don't know what I would have done.
He not only carried that, every one of them had a gun strapped to the leg, and you wasn't supposed to have it. And they flew in and made it to Texas, and every one of them landed safe in them. And they all painted them and fixed them up, and you still see most of them out there, I guess.
Most of them are around. Some of them have gone bye-bye.
Yeah. $5,000. I'm just trying. I mean, it's just hard to fathom a Corsair.
What do you want with them? I mean, what do you want to do with them when they're burning? The least you could ever get by burning gallons an hour, probably 85 gallon hour, isn't it? Idling.
Yeah, 70 to 100 gallons an hour. It depends on the power that you're carrying.
Yeah, but avgas used to be cheap.
Like, yeah, never cheap. Yeah. Never cheap. Cheaper than it is now. Of course, the hardest thing now is getting it, is getting gas that's good enough for these big
engine.
Radial engines. They're convinced that they can get the lead out of the atmosphere, and you know, it's an admirable concept. The problem is the amount of lead that's put into the air by the total number of airplanes like this is so small that it almost wonder, you know, are we killing the bird to get the nest, you know, or something.
So this is something that most of my listeners probably haven't thought about, and that is what is required to run these warbirds. I know they hold and use a lot of oil. They use a lot of fuel. What exactly is a spec for that? What kind of fuel do we really need to make these things go? They used to run on 8087, didn't they, in the day?
No, it was you can't run these on 8087. You needed 100 to 120 or 140, or they run much better when you get up to the higher octanes. You can derate them.
So military spec fuel was always a higher octane in those days.
Well, that a lot of people don't know that one of the reasons that the Brits did so well in the Battle of Britain was that Roosevelt opened up the embargo and shipped them tankers of tetraethyl lead, and they used it, which increased the performance of the Spitfire enormously, and because you need it to cool the engine and to lubricate the valves. And so it's surprised the Germans didn't have that. That's the one thing that really gave the Brits an advantage.
So, performance-wise, even now, I think you can still add that to your fuel, can't you?
Well, they've been able to derate some of these engines and change them around a little bit, but some of them you can't go far enough below.
Is that the same thing as what's in TCP, that product called TCP?
No, I don't believe that you can put lead in anything today. I mean, they have 100 low lead. I mean, it's really reduced significantly. Even racing, you don't add lead. You use other things, manganese, for instance, which is highly toxic, but it is legal. And so you put in manganese and, you know, a bunch of other things to keep the temperatures down. The induction temperature is life itself in a big engine. That's your most important gauge.
One of the things we don't want to forget, though, we're talking about, that's just one mission that he made. We've got stories of our friends that took off in a Mustang to bring it back, and the hoses went out on him, and he took his parachute off, wrapped his legs up while he went in and died in the airplane, trying to keep from steaming to death. We had lots of deaths, lots of people, but they still helped bring this to life. And that's what you have to go back and think about, what happened from the big turn of it. You weren't buying, you were buying junk a lot of times and fixing them up. And there's no junk out there on that field now.
No.
Nowhere.
Not at all.
All the way down to the trainers. Same thing.
Bill, we were going to talk about some numbers. Harold kind of passed that off to you. What are you seeing?
What am I what?
What are you seeing, numbers-wise?
Here?
Yeah.
We're down just a little bit in terms of total numbers of airplanes, but the weather was bad. They're coming in. If they don't get in today, we will be down because most of them really won't come if it's only two or three days.
Well, it's quite an operation to get a warbird here.
It is, and there's always a frontal line. I mean, John Ball lives in Nashville, and I live in Tulsa. And John can call me, and I'll tell him what the weather is going to be in Nashville tomorrow because it's what the same as what it is in Tulsa today.
Yeah.
But there's a frontal system that always goes across the country, and you will have weather. It depends on where it is. And so, you know, these airplanes are quite capable of handling some weather, but they're just too valuable to do that with. You try to make visual flight.
Yeah. I don't want to forget to mention this while we have you here the next couple minutes. Let's talk about the air show. We've got Jim Zazas coming up to talk about the actual specifics of the inner workings of the Warbird Air Show. But what's happening this week? What have you got planned?
Warbird Air Show? Well, it's big. You know, we have pyro and there will be some formation flying and the different groups will fly in formations. We have assault type things, some helicopters. The jets are flying. I mean, anything that has to do with Warbird aviation will be flying.
Yeah, and our listeners, of course, you might know this, but they can stream that air show live on EAA Radio, either here on the grounds. They can listen to it from the campground, or they can listen to it from the outer perimeter where they can't hear the announcer stand. They can hear it on 96.5 FM or 1210 AM, or on the web, even if they're not here, at EAARadio.net. And we've got these little things called webcams now. So they can actually feel more like they're here now with the webcams that we have all over the grounds this year. So they can see a lot of that activity, and they can listen to the announcer during the Warbird
Air Show. I don't think anybody will be bored.
Absolutely not. No, you can't be bored at a Warbird Air Show. Well, Harold Cannon was saying that he's here now because of a Warbird Air Show many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. And it is truly one of the big highlights of EAA Air Venture is the work that you guys do to put on that incredible air show, and not just once, but numerous times.
Tell them about the survey that was done of the people leaving.
We had Bill and I go way back on a survey. It happened. Used to, we'd have the Warbird show at the front, very part thing, and we looked up, and people were leaving. And this is nothing bad about it, but they were leaving. And we kept on trying to find out why. So we put people at every gate and asked these people when they turned around and left, why are you leaving? And the show just started. They said, we came to see the Warbirds. So they took that before the board of directors back then and gave them this 85% of them said they left or came because of the Warbirds. So they were going home because the Warbirds finished. The attitude totally on this whole camp here changed because they realized that we were here to have fun and for everybody. And we weren't, some of our people weren't very nice way back then either, but everybody's together on this, and it's shown it, it's grown. Yeah.
And it's a nice area and a bunch of great people. Awesome. We're going to take a break, gentlemen, and we'll be back and talk more Warbird stuff here. You're listening to EAA Radio.